Good morning. It's Sunday, May 3rd, and time for the morning roundup of world news. From the newsroom in San Francisco, here's an important bulletin from Chongqing, China. The Chinese now officially admit that the Japanese entered Mandalay on May 1st. A communique from Chongqing says fighting and great confusion occurred in the former Burma capital. Now, for a first-hand report of the fighting in the Southwest Pacific, we take you to United Nations headquarters in Australia. Go ahead, Australia.
This is Sydney Albright calling from Australia. Early last week, when the Japanese increased the ferocity of their attacks on Australia's north and eastern fronts, it was first thought by most observers here that the enemy was acting more or less in self-defense. The continued Allied raids on their bases had cost them dearly and prevented all attempts at moderate or large-scale concentrations of shipping. With the two Japanese planes appearing over Townsville, a more ominous note has been struck. The danger of regaining aerial superiority in the Darwin and New Guinea areas is minimized by the imminence of a more direct peril. No confirmation is obtainable here of the presence of an enemy shipping concentration, as stated in the agency reports from America. On the other hand, there have been no denials, but speculation points to an attempt to attack either New Caledonia or Australia's northeastern seaboard, or both. In the event of an attack on the eastern seaboard, Port Moresby in New Guinea would be partially isolated, as was the case in Sumatra, one of the few occasions when the Japanese adopted cutting-corner tactics. By striking at Palembang in central Sumatra, instead of moving from Malaya to Medan, then working down to Palembang, the arrival of two enemy planes over Townsville in Queensland was the first time that an alert has been sounded in the east coast of Australia and that anti-aircraft guns have gone into action. It is thought that these machines, which were flying at a great height, were engaged in reconnaissance operations. Meanwhile, Allied aircraft continues to hammer the enemy on a wide front with unrelenting fury. The communique issued today describes an attack by our bombers on Rabaul, where a direct hit was scored on one transport, another damaged, and a tender capsized. Eight Japanese fighters intercepted, two of which were shot down and four damaged. At Port Moresby, 15 Zulu fighters attacked the airdrome yesterday. Our fighters intercepted successfully, destroying four enemy planes and damaging two others. Detailed reports of the Allied raid of April 30th on Salamoa reveal that our attacking planes bombed and destroyed three enemy flying boats on the water. Apparently, enemy air raids are continuing at Tulagi in the Solomon Islands, but no details have been disclosed. The communique states that there have been no changes in the Corregidor and the Visayan areas, and it further adds that the situation is static on the Cotabato front in Mindanao. A few weeks ago, I reported the loss near Broome of a Dutch passenger plane piloted by the famous Captain Smirnoff. An interesting sidelight on the story has been disclosed with the arrival in Broome of a wandering beachcomber. The plane, which was one of the last to leave Java, was carrying a parcel of diamonds valued at approximately $1 million. Captain Smirnoff, on the way, was radio warned of the attack on Broome. He stayed clear of danger until the all clear. As he reached Carnot Bay, 60 miles north of Broome, homeward bound, Japanese raiders intercepted and shot him down. Of the seven men, two and the woman and the child aboard were wounded. The woman died almost immediately, and the man and the child died some days later. Smirnoff sent to the plane for his briefcase and the parcel of jewelry. The parcel was missing. Natives discovered the castaways, and they were rescued. Recently, a middle-aged, ill-clad beachcomber called at an army office to enlist. He nonchalantly mentioned that 2 weeks before at Carnot Bay, he kicked a paper object, partly embedded in tidal mud. It fell to pieces, spreading diamonds over the mud. The casual beachcomber produced a large set of salt and pepper shakers, and, like throwing dice, he cascaded a glittering spray of diamonds over the table. I now return you to San Francisco.
Now, for further reports, it's eastward across the United States to the newsroom in New York.
here in New York, and now across another ocean for our next report to London and John McVane.
This is London. John McVane speaking.
The RAF kept up its big daylight operations today. Large formations of British planes were seen shuttling back and forth over the British coast, heading in the general direction of Calais. Last night was a comparatively quiet one in the air war. British planes laid mines in enemy waters and attacked enemy shipping. Off Aalesund, Norway, a big German tanker was bombed and set afire. It was still blazing an hour later when British planes bombed it again. A cargo vessel was also set on fire. Not much news from the British fighting fronts has reached London so far today. In Libya, small enemy patrols that moved east of the Axis forward positions were driven back. The British are still fighting on the Chindwin front in Burma, and there's been no change in the situation. On the Irrawaddy front, the Japanese advance has been a cautious one, and British artillery has been raking the enemy heavily. The Japanese shelled one position 24 hours after the British had evacuated it. London defenses are being tested today by a mock invasion of parachutists and airborne troops. The attacking forces are supposed to be trying to seize key government offices in Buckingham Palace. Regular troops and home guards are defending the Westminster area of London. The invasion exercise was begun by fifth columnists and sabotage experts. They dressed in British service and civil defense uniforms, sent fake messages, and tried to assassinate Britain's military and political leaders. Umpires were on hand when some supposed fifth columnists penetrated into the War Office, and others tried to find out the whereabouts of the royal family. Last night, the police stood by and watched while the fifth column group flickered their flashlights in the sky to help the German bombers who were supposed to be raiding the Westminster section. It was the first time the London blackout had been broken since the war, that is, with official permission. This week's election of two independents to Parliament has been a warning to both the Conservative and Labour Party leaders. The British people at the moment want men with snap and drive, men with the offensive spirit, to represent them in Parliament. But during this party truce, the attitude of political leaders in picking party wheel horses to fill vacancies in the Commons has been reminiscent of the time the Tammany machine picked John P. O'Brien to run for mayor against LaGuardia in New York City. Official candidates said, in effect, "I'll support Churchill and always vote with the government." The independents said, "I'll support Churchill, but I'll demand harder and more efficient effort to win the war and deal with economic problems." Remember that for a long time, the Conservative Party machine kept a man of Churchill's ability out in the cold. Sir Stafford Cripps is still outside the official Labour Party. Then remember that a good many Labour voters feel that their party leaders have been swallowed up by the Conservatives and the national government. They feel their demands for broad social reforms aren't getting any consideration, that manpower is being drafted but not property. The result is that the decisive votes go to any independent candidate who looks as though he had some personal ability and promises the right things. This is John McVane in London, returning you to New York.
David Anderson, our reporter in the Swedish capital, is standing by, and we take you now for him, and he reports from Stockholm.
Hello, New York. This is David Anderson speaking from Stockholm. The Germans are now openly stating that they expect Turkey to join up with the Axis at some future date. This, at least, is what Dr. Adolf Hellfeld, Berlin editor of the Hamburger Spendenblatt, states after his return from a visit to the Turkish capital. This report, then, comes almost simultaneous with the American announcement that Iraq and Iran were to secure leaseland aid and that the Turks were on the preference list for leaseland material. Here are some of the arguments given by Dr. Hellfeld to substantiate his claims. In the first place, says his report, Turkey's neutrality is not static, but rather it is forced on her by circumstance. Secondly, Turkey's neutrality is realistic, and at a given time when the obvious advantages can be seen from her participation with the Axis, Germany hopes that Turkey will take the natural steps toward the Axis. This point, says Dr. Hellfeld, may be reached as soon as the spring offensive begins and the Germans have reached the Caucasus. Of course, he goes on, the Turks will be given rich booty for their participation, such as territory in the Caucasus. Thirdly, German comment to his article refers to the strong trade ties which now bind Turkey with the Axis, and even mentioned the presence of a representative of the Turkish news agency in Berlin. It is not my purpose to comment on the Turkish conditions from Stockholm, but this report is so much more interesting since it follows hardly 2 months after von Papen's remarkable admission in Berlin that Turkey would defend herself from any attack. And as such, it strongly resembles Sweden's position. If we can draw any parallel between the position of Turkey and that of Sweden, it must certainly be that neither of these countries intend being involved with any of the belligerents as long as their neutrality is not infringed upon. With that in mind, both Turkey and Sweden have developed a defense organization which is far stronger than it was prior to the war. Firm neutrality is what the Swedes prefer to call it. So if we can draw any conclusions today, it would be that Turkey, just like Sweden, aims to remain neutral no matter how great the booty may be. This is David Annis returning you to New York.
And from our New York newsroom, this bulletin. London. Recent British bombing attacks have severely damaged the German battleships Gneisenau and Scharnhorst, and the cruiser Prince Eugen had been badly damaged by a submarine attack. This is announced by the British today in a joint Admiralty Air Ministry communique. And now for word on developments here at home, we take you to the newsroom in Washington.
Before bringing you the news of the nation's capital, here is a bulletin from Reykjavik, Iceland. The Iceland war zone has seen its first air fight. United States Army authorities reveal that a Norwegian plane caught a long-range Nazi bomber off guard. The Norse pilot spotted the German over the sea. He roared in, opened fire, and poured tracer bullets into the enemy's fuselage. The bomber fired back bullet for bullet, and in a desperate maneuver, the German pilot dove his bomber through a cloud bank to within 100 feet of the sea. That's how he escaped, although the Norwegian tried to stay on his tail. The Nazi bomber apparently was damaged, but the Norwegian plane went unscathed, and its crew was unhurt. The general sales tax is again forcing its way into the spotlight on Capitol Hill. Many influential members of Congress feel that the sales levy is the only way to raise over $7 billion in new taxes, as recommended by President Roosevelt. The House Ways and Means Committee, which is considering the new tax bill, has already hiked corporation taxes to yield $2.5 billion a year. As a result, more than $5 billion must be obtained from increases in individual income and other revenue sources. In addition, many of the committee members, like Representative Robinson of Virginia, say that the new tax bill should go beyond the figure which the Treasury has asked, should go perhaps even so far as $9 billion. For this reason, these committee men and many other influential members feel that a general retail sales tax is the only solution. Administration spokesmen have already gone on record as being strongly opposed to the sales levy, and organized labor, particularly the CIO, has also expressed its opposition. If a sales tax is voted by the committee, and many members feel that it has at least an even chance, the CIO can be expected to make a bitter fight against it on the House floor and in the Senate. In a nationwide referendum, farmers appear to have approved a government proposal to continue rigid marketing quotas for the 1942 wheat crop. Incomplete but conclusive returns are now in from 35 of the 40 wheat-producing states. These returns show that 73% of the farmers are all for the control program. Only two-thirds of the vote is needed to put the plan into effect. Agriculture Department officials say they expect complete returns to boost the majority to around 80%. Voting yesterday was unusually light. The sharpest opposition to the wheat control proposal came in Ohio, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey. The marketing system is aimed at saving the wheat farmer from the consequences of glutting the market with a wheat crop far in excess of demand or possible consumption. One of the biggest mass registrations in the country begins tomorrow. In case you've forgotten, that's the start of the four-day registration for the first sugar ration books. The books may be obtained by one member out of each family, and the government wants every family represented. That's because the sugar sign-up may serve as a basis for later rationing of other commodities, should that become necessary. The primary reason, however, is the simple fact that you can't get sugar without a ration book. And by the way, when you folks go to register tomorrow, be sure to know the age, weight, and height of the other members of your family. They'll ask you for it. And so for the moment, that's all from Washington.
These have been the reports by John McVane from London, Sidney Albright from Australia, David Anderson in Stockholm, with additional developments reported from our newsroom in Washington and New York. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.